Thanks everyone for tuning in though. This is our Sunday weekly live stream. We do this every single Sunday at 8:45. This is also on a podcast. So if those of you who are listening on a podcast, welcome as well. So what we kind of do here on the show is we go over some overall beer news, some news in the beer industry that might affect your life. And then we talk about some genius news, some stuff here that hopefully affects your life as well because you like to hear what's going on with us. And then we go through a beer of the week and two topics that are talking about beer and how to make it.
Yeah, so let's go right into some brewing news to get started with. We have Atlantic City is one signature away. They might have even signed it yesterday. Who knows? But of allowing people to drink and consume alcohol on the boardwalk there, and I feel it seems like some other places as well. So that's kind of cool. It sounds like that city's really stepping up to bat for all of the small businesses that I'm sure are there. So potentially this week, if you live down in Atlantic City or are visiting it, you can go into a bar or a brewery, buy a beer, walk out, and just walk around and drink it. So that's kind of cool because it sounds like small businesses need that.
As more places are shutting down, that is, so basically this is so hopefully going to be a precedent in other places too, with governments trying to open up more in more unique ways that help small breweries still be able to sell product, even though gathering indoors might not be acceptable.
So, yep. Otherwise, Greg Koch's battle continues on with the lawsuit over the name Stone, right?
Yeah, so he actually released a statement this last week basically saying that he and Sawstone tried to have a settlement a long time ago, and the lawyers did some back and forth for about 3 months, and then Sawstone went radio silent. So he's basically trying to say, hey, it's not my fault. Sawstone responded to their statement saying they just weren't comfortable with what Stone was trying to push, basically saying that if they were to keep their name Sawstone, they would have to drop the trademark rights to Sawstone, which is very, very counterintuitive, and severely limit distribution, which even though Sawstone is a three-barrel brewery, they obviously don't want to limit what they can do in the future. They want to be able to expand outside their own county eventually, and so they were not happy with saying they cannot distribute outside their own county.
By the way, I just got a mid-roll ad. We apologize for the ads that may be popping up. It's a new thing with YouTube, by the way. It's sounds like it's really annoying, and we're trying to fix it right now. So
yeah, let me know if there's anything I can do to try to fix it on the back end. I went through and manually deleted a lot of them this morning.
Yep.
So.
All right. And then, Stone Brewing continues on with their lawsuit. Meanwhile, hashtag Genus Tone.
Nothing wrong with this.
Definitely not going to get sued over that one. So yeah, if you want to buy a t-shirt, actually, we probably don't have them for sale, do we?
They are live on our website.
Oh, okay.
You know, why not?
We do. All right. Speaking about breweries feeling the pinch, sounds like some breweries around the nation are kind of finally thrown in the towel when it comes to Skull Mechanic Brewing and Mustache Brewing. And it kind of sucks because it sounds like they both had very community-based business models where they wanted people in a tap room focused on, you know, live music, lots of fun events. So obviously they're getting hit hardest. While Bell's Brewing, which is a very large brewery, if those of you out there are aware, is actually expanding their distribution into, I believe, Oklahoma now. So they're in most states by now. And so this kind of brings up the question for me of you know, are you at a huge disadvantage if you don't have a large amount of capital invested in a canning line and distribution?
And definitely, yeah, there's a lot of small breweries that also don't know how to get all the government resources that come to them. And there's a lot of large breweries that have the best lawyers and accountants basically snagging up every penny.
Yeah,
because a lot of that in the first round of PPP was labor-based, meaning large breweries, even if they're doing better or they're expanding distribution during this time, they're still getting all that free government funding that's subsidized. And so they're making out like a robber thief person.
Yeah. And so then, it's a tricky situation. I feel like it's nothing new though.
Bandits. Making out like bandits.
The small
That's
guy.
The word.
The small guys always seem to get the brunt of things. So somebody said if we can pause during ads. I would, but there is usually a 10 to 30 second delay. So I doubt my pauses would be synchronized with the ads, unfortunately.
Let's see if I can do something to stop the ads.
All right. Yeah, you go do that. I'll keep going through some Genus news. So let's start out with some Belgian IPA that we made up here in, I think we did a two-barrel batch of that, if I remember correctly. Belgian IPA / strong ale / triple Belgian something. I don't really know. All I know is Tim was throwing pounds and pounds of hops at this beer, and the OG was like 11 on it or something like that. It was 1.1 something. So it was way the heck up there. So it's going to be a big beer. And otherwise, we got some Blickman stuff finally coming in, specifically the Anvils. And I think we ordered some other supplies from them, right?
Yeah. We got some Anvil Foundries coming in, some 10.5s on that. And then we also got some fun oxygenation kits, some ways that people can oxygenate their beers, as well as I saw they have this like a cooling rod looking thing that sticks into a carboy stopper.
Oh yeah, so one of those things, a little.
If you already have some glycol, it's a pretty easy way to go ahead and, you know, add some stuff to your things.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. So it's glycol based. That's nice.
Yeah.
So we got our Blickman supplies finally coming in. So I'm excited for that because we have had a ton of people wanting those Anvils, and they're a great product. So
yeah.
We also started seltzer trials here. So hard seltzers, obviously a thing now. And it turns out there is a ton of different methods to make them and a ton of different sort of, I don't know what the word to say is, like different ideas of what people think is the right or wrong way to do them.
Yeah.
So we currently have three different variations going right now. We just started them doing 5-gallon batches. So we're going to be playing around with those. We're going to be experimenting, figure out which one turns out the best, and then obviously sharing those results with you.
Yeah. So right now, basically, we have as a yeast experiment, we have three different seltzers going on, one with Bubbles from Imperial, one with a Saison yeast, and then one with classic EC1118, which is the most common yeast that you see in recipes. Also, let me know if the ad problem is fixed on that. I think I got it taken care of, but
yeah, I haven't seen
let
it
me know.
Anymore, so. Yeah. The Bubbles, I'm going to laugh when the Bubbles is the one, because that's a yeast months and months back, and we can't get it anymore. So anyway, otherwise we also had our first impressions of Pog yeast from, speaking of Imperial.
Yeah.
That is the seasonal A37. So we pitched that into a sort
juicy
of
juicy IPA.
Yeah, into a juicy week and a half ago now. And
it's dried out more than we thought it was. And it's actually almost, because we fermented that on the warmer end of the temperature spectrum.
Yeah, 100.
Yeah.
It was hot.
So, but it's coming across a little bit farmhousey. So maybe that the super juiciness from Pog comes at a little bit lower temperature than we were expecting. And at the warmer temperature, it gets a little juicy mixed with farmhouse. I don't know. We'll find out. We'll keep playing with it. But right now that beer is tasting super delicious.
Yeah, so there you go. So that is our first impressions of Pog. I mean, we did ferment at 100 degrees. You're going to get a little farmhousey out of, I feel like, anything.
But, yeah.
And then what else we got here? We got, Kastermuncher is back.
Kastermuncher is back. That is our rotating coffee kolsch. We kind of change it up for different seasons and different styles. But the most recent one is a great summer edition. We made it nice and light and crispy, which means that coffee flavor on top pops just incredibly. It's a really good balanced beer, and I think it's the perfect way to drink coffee in the summer.
Yeah, we got that back on Wednesday. I've actually had, I think, two or three people come up and actually tell us this was their favorite version so far. So
yeah, I think it's my second favorite version so far.
So that's kind of cool. Peter, you also have something to say too, by the way.
Sure.
Yeah.
On what?
At the very top there.
Oh, yeah. So last week I forgot to wish happy birthday to a couple people named Kieran and Lisa. They happened to be my son and my wife, and they didn't get mad at me at all when I got home for forgetting to wish them a happy birthday on the live stream. And so I'm doing this purely out of the grace of my heart.
It's all right. I don't think I said that to my son. So
I think I said it to your son on his birthday.
Oh, did you?
On the live stream.
For the win. All right. And then on top of that, we do have a bunch of new followers on Instagram. So if you are not on Instagram, please check that out. Peter's actually been kicking some butt, getting some awesome photos. Ryan's been turning them into some crazy, unique little concepts. So please check that out on Instagram.
Follow us on Instagram. It's a great way to get a hold of us also, and then just kind of connect with us in a different way than we do with the videos. You get to see a little bit more personality and fun stuff happening around the brewery. And also... We have put out some stuff on TikTok. I don't know if any of you guys are on TikTok.
Oh,
but
TikTok.
It's a fun way to do some different stuff and share our personality with the world. So follow us on that.
And then to wrap up news here, we did see that some of you out there, I'm sure you saw us through YouTube, we're purchasing some beer kits from us. So always feel free to check out our website. I think I'm going to try to work on a third kit to put up there right now. It seems like it's chugging along nicely. So we got our West Coast IPA kit up there and our Caster Muncher kit right now.
Thank you to those of you who have supported us. And yeah, feel free to check those out.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think it's time to go on to
our beer of the week. Boop, 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 boop. Beer of the week. Boop, boop.
And that is a category 24C, which is Beer de Gare. This is a really random one I came across, but it's a fun one.
It's really fun one.
I'll be straightforward. I've never actually brewed one. Now I really want to.
I have brewed a Beer de Gare, and I'm pretty sure when I brewed it wrong, because this is before my long tenure in the brewing industry. Yeah. So the one that I ended up with when I brewed it back in my fledgling homebrew years was like sickly sweet Belgian-y. Beer de Gare is actually more of a farmhouse style ale. It is a slightly malt leaning farmhouse style ale, similar to a Saison, but instead of the bright pepperiness that you can get off of the Saison, Beer de Gare is going to be more malt leaning and a little bit more Belgian fruity.
Yeah, so they're known for having a profile that is, for a Belgian beer, exceptionally clean, crisp, despite being a high alcohol content.
Yep.
So these beers, to kind of put things into perspective, OG of 1060 to 1080 with final gravities of, what was it, 1.008 to like 1012 was all?
Alcohol percentage, I believe, was 6 to 8.5.
Yeah. So really low final gravity. So these are very dry beers. And one thing that it does state in these style guidelines, I'm going to pause for a second.
We got a firehouse right near us.
One of the things it does state in the style guidelines is that these are actually lagered. So it's not typical of a lot of other Belgian styles, especially those ones like Peter is saying that are,
yeah,
you know, huge malt bombs, big, thick, chewy, sweet. This is sort of the opposite end of the spectrum.
The guard is the storage or the lagering period that these beers go through. So they do end up like that, like you said, like bright and dry and crisp. And they're just kind of a fun way to balance fruitier, maltier flavors with dry, clean beer.
Yep. So the on top of that dryness, we are still trying to accentuate the malt character in these beers. These beers should have very, very little to no hop character at all. So the hops are very subdued. IBUs are actually moderate. I believe they're in the mid-20s is what you're going to be shooting for IBUs. But with that said, that's basically just going to be a bittering addition. I honestly wouldn't probably try to finish it with any hops at all, if I were to take a stab at it. And so, yeah, do remember that, you know, there's very little hop aroma, very little hop flavor, unless you're on the very light side.
It's all about the malts and the fermentation.
Yeah.
Talking about malts, for example, we didn't learn to say malts, did we? That was reading.
You're reading? No, we have not. I'm just going over the style itself.
The malt. Oh, because you were talking about hops, and so I was like, I thought you were on the hops already.
Oh, yeah. No, we're just gonna go into it. All right. So that's the style. So let's
yeah.
Let's go into our malt of the week.
Malt of the week, honey malt / brew malt.
Yeah. So brew malt is a sort of Maillard based malt. It's gonna have a little bit of acidity. It's gonna have a little bit of sweetness and a nice little complex sugar character.
Yeah, so basically what that's going to do is give you a feeling of sweetness without all the sweetness that can come from like a crystal type malt.
Yep.
It can keep it nice and biscuity as well. And then these malts are going to have a touch of acidity too to help kind of brighten or, you know,
yeah,
lighten up the whole profile.
Yep, so Beer de Gare are known for having a very malt-forward profile, specifically those biscuit and toasty notes to them. And I think while it might not be super toasty, the brew malt will definitely give you that rich biscuit profile. So I would use that per 5-gallon batch. I would probably dose that pretty heavy, actually. I would go shoot for close to a pound.
Yeah.
And it is a pretty pungent malt, so I think a pound of that will get you about where you need to be. And with that said, we are going to be using that on top of, you know, a nice light Pilsner base malt, something of that nature. If you do want to make, there are several versions of this, actually. There's like golden, amber, and something else.
Brown.
Brown, yeah. So you will obviously have to use some darker malts as well. If you want to hit those darker, you know, the amber and brown styles, where you might be using additional Munich malt in there, and you might even have
a touch of crystal malt in there.
Yeah, a touch of crystal.
Or like a Kara Munich or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of build out some of those flavors with more unique middle malts if you're going for the darker end of the spectrum. Yeah. But that said, still start with a nice light Pilsner base on all those.
Yeah.
A lot of the golden to ambery hued ones will have a little bit of something like the honey malt that we're talking about, but then build out that middle with a lot of Munich malt.
Yep. And then one thing to never forget about, honestly, every Belgian style is Belgian candy sugar as well.
Yep.
So
this is a French style, but on the border.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely you're going to want to throw some candy sugar in there too. That's going to get your beer to dry out to those low numbers. I would probably shoot for about a pound of that as well. And that should get you in that same wheelhouse. Unless you're brewing those real dark versions, I would tend to stick towards the lighter end of the spectrum when it comes to candy sugar. Five Lovibond is probably fine. You know, your golden candy sugars or even your clear candy sugars.
Yeah, or you can even use some simple sugars like regular table sugar or like beet sugar if you have access to those. The candy sugar is going to be a little bit more expensive. Yeah. I like the flavors of them, so I think it's always worth going with.
When in doubt, something highly fermentable just to keep that beer nice and crispy.
Yeah, but more importantly than adding the simple sugars to make this beer nice and dry is actually adding a diastaticus variant yeast, a yeast that's going to be kind of helping to keep dry that beer out during the long storage periods. And so what we did, there are a lot of beer de garde yeasts that are basically a hybrid style yeast. It's a diastaticus variant that you can ferment 70 to 85 degrees and get that nice farmhousey Belgian kind of mixed vibe. But if you don't have those yeasts, what we opted to do is go with monastic combined with cable car and ferment it at 75 degrees.
Yep. So that's exactly because what I think a beer de garde strain, a typical strain, is actually it's a Belgian lager strain, right? Or some kind of a hybrid lager strain that's actually a diastaticus variant at the same time, which is a very unique quality and a yeast strain. So that's why we're kind of recommending actually the co-pitching, where you have some kind of a more neutral strain that's going to end up with a really nice crispy finish, like the Cow Lager strain, and then as well as a nice Belgian diastaticus strain, so that you get a little bit of those nice little herbal peppery notes in there.
Yeah.
And that is our yeast kind of that we jumped to real fast. So that is our yeast of the week is going to be Monastic and Cable Car from Imperial.
Yep.
So, and then let's talk about our hop of the week so that we don't glance over it because hops are still important. And I chose a pretty traditional hop for this beer style, which is going to be Tettnang. Tettnang is a classic. I believe that is a noble hop, right? It's in the nobles.
Yeah.
I'm going to call it that anyway. And so Tettnang, pretty low alphas. Like I said, really not much going on with it. It is known for being a nice herbal, earthy, fairly mild profile to it. And I would probably dose that with for a 5-gallon batch to get where you want. You probably want to put about an ounce and a half, maybe even 2 ounces straight at bittering, and then more or less call that a day. So boil that for 60 minutes, and it should get you in that 20-ish IBU range.
See, I thought you talked about that when you were talking about the style when I jumped into the...
Yeah, no, I didn't. That's all right.
But you said, it doesn't really matter, though. It's a 60-minute edition. You can use anything in that noble/peppery range.
Yeah. If you don't want to use Tettnang, you know, Hallertau would be another, you know, good, straightforward one, too. Even Pearl. I don't see anything wrong with that.
Sterling.
Yep.
Whatever. Water profile. Let's talk about something more interesting in this style. So this, there can be a range of water profiles, and generally you're not looking for anything too aggressive, but something that leans slightly minerally can actually help balance the farmhouse feel of the beer.
So we actually looked up the water profile and had a really hard time nailing it down for a beer de garde. It seems like this style is just obscure enough that there's not a lot of data out there. But what I can say is that we looked up general French, Belgian, German profiles, and it seems like you want a fairly balanced profile for this style of beer. And so if you guys happen to, you know, be in a place that has a lot of beer de garde and know the profile of it, please comment down below and call us out. But what I'm going to take a stab at is to go for a moderate to high bicarbonate load in that sort of 100 to 200 ppm range. I know that's a huge range, but So that's going to be the bicarb load with dissolved calcium in that 50 to 100 range. And then a chloride to sulfate ratio of slightly higher on the chlorides, if not pretty well balanced. So let's just say 80 ppm of chloride and 50 ppm of sulfates. And then a little bit of magnesium, never going to hurt nothing. And then I did notice that pretty much all of the cities around that area have some degree of salt. So you will want to have at least, I would say, 10 to 20 ppm of some sodium in there. And again, especially for this sort of lager type situation, I think that'll really help round out that finish. And yeah, I think that should pretty much do it for the water profile. I know that was probably like a really quick thing that everybody's wondering what I just did, but
yeah.
And a little bit of magnesium never hurts anything either, but you probably already have that in your water. So,
and you already said that.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Okay.
I kind of zoned out during that. That got really boring for me, I'll be honest. Let's go on to topic number one. Topic number one is something that we can talk at length, and hopefully it's something that you guys are interested in slash wanted to hear about when you clicked on this video, and that is going to be how is malt made and what gives it flavor?
Yeah, so malt is, I mean, obviously a major component of beer, and the flavor is going to vary depending on the maltster, depending on, where it grows, depending on so many things, kilning process, malting process, I mean, you name it.
Let's talk about the first and most important part of malt, and it's a very, very overlooked attribute when it comes to the flavors that you get in your base grain, and that is actually what the varietal itself is, and that can have to do with the species, the breed of the grain, that can have to do with where it's grown, that can have to do with who grows it, and like what the weather was that year. There can be a very, very broad range when it comes to the grain that goes into the malting process, and that has a huge impact on actually what the final flavor and diastatic power of that malt can be.
Yeah. So one thing that the bigger maltsters especially are going to do is they're going to go in, they're going to analyze these grains because they're looking for consistency, right? So they're going to go out to a field, they're going to test for protein, moisture content, you name it. And then they are actually going to blend a whole bunch of different crops together because they are trying to get the most consistent malt possible so that you in turn can have the most consistent beer possible. However, on a smaller scale, it's a little more difficult to do that. And so that's got its pros and cons, right?
There's a lot of maltsters that lean into different species of grains. And the brewing community has taken note of this, and a lot of brewers are actually jumping on the fact that that there is a big variety in species of grains. So now you see bigger maltsters like Hugh Baird's doing heritage varietals or like old world varietals that are single crop, and then so they can vary from year to year. But what that means is that the protein content in these less modified grains, these grains that are not necessarily bred for a low profile content for like high beer consistency, they can impact that flavor of the beer, and they can also impact the diastatic power of the beer. What that means is the enzymes that make it so that your malt can get you simple sugars, can get you maltose. One of our favorite malts that we use actually is called Heidelberg malt, and one of the reasons that Heidelberg malt is so highly enzymatic is just because it's a breed of grain that happens to be more enzymatic.
Yeah. So we got all these fun new varieties always coming out. And I think the trade-off with those is actually it's going to be you're trading off consistency sometimes for the flavor that you're getting from them, right?
It's going to be me.
But yeah, so that's definitely a trade-off. We've had some really big flavors, especially like the Maris Otter ones. Like the heritage varieties of Maris Otter have been absolutely fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about really how we get those flavors out of the malt and the process of making it.
So on the basic level, what malting is, it's taking the seeds of the barley or whatever grain that you're using to malt, and you are tricking them into becoming a plant. You're germinating them. And so what the plant itself does is says, I'm about to grow a plant. I need a lot of energy. So it breaks down some cell walls, and it starts producing a lot of sugar or sugar precursors inside the grains. Then when that happens and the malts are nice and sugary, the maltster goes ahead and dries those grains out to stop the process, and then they cook them to varying degrees.
Yeah, so the drying and cooking process is really how when we start to differentiate one malt from another and our base malt specifically from our specialty malts. Kilning is typically done at low temperatures for a fairly short amount of time for all of what we know as base malts. And what that actually does is that preserves those enzymes that Peter is talking about during the germination step, so that we can still use them in beer.
In the mashing step, yeah. So all your base malts from a Pilsner malt, which is going to be the lightest color, to about a pale ale malt, which is going to come in at 3 to 4 units Lovibond. Those will have relatively high diastatic power. Usually Pilsner malt will have just a slightly higher diastatic power than a pale ale malt. But once you get darker into that, into like the Munich malts, where you want some more breadiness, some more toastiness, and some more character out of your malt, the proteins, the enzymes that make your beer sugary for you, those start to degrade because of the high temperatures.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's, without oversimplifying it too much, there is a correlation with the higher temperature of the malt. Obviously, the darker the color gets, and it changes the flavor from... And let's just kind of keep it on the dry side for now.
Yeah.
So it'll change that flavor from, you know, a nice, light, grainy, neutral profile. And it changes it from that to kind of your biscuity profile to, and then it starts getting into your burnt profiles. And then you start getting into those chocolate and those kind of almost meaty and smoky characters as you get way towards the end of the spectrum there.
Yeah, so in the very light end, something that you might use up to, let's say, 60, even 100% of your malts, you've got something like your Viennas and your Munichs, which those, if you use in a high percentage, can have a very nice biscuit toasty malt character in your beer. But when you get, even those, if you use 100% of them in your grain bill, it's still not going to be overly cloying. It's not going to be overly sweet. They can come across nice and light. But then when you get into things like a true biscuit malt or a victory malt or things like that, in that 20 level bond range, you start sacrificing most of your diastatic power. They don't want 100% convert. You can't use them 100% in your beer. But that flavor is more intense. And so you can play around with different base malts at that point.
Yeah. Which is also why we're generally going to use a lot less of these quote unquote specialty malts in beer, is because they can't convert themselves. But also they have way more flavor than you need. I mean, if you were doing,
use a lot of those.
Yeah, I'm sure your brewers out there would be laughing if like you had a recipe that had 50% black malt in it.
Like, I've seen it happen.
Chewing on an ashtray.
Yeah.
All right.
So the hotter temperatures are generally what you're using to get to those like burnt kind of characters.
Yep.
And then the lower temperatures are going to be what you use to get that range, because it's easier to stop at an exact level bond on the lower temperature range. And so when you're getting into those kind of like toasty, bready feels, a nice slow cook is what's going to give you those.
Yep.
There is another – you're going on to the other thing?
Yeah, you go. You do it, girl.
There is another faction of malts, however, which are not dried before going into the kilning process. Can you guess what those are and why?
I'll give you a hint. They're caramely.
Yeah, that's good.
So these are going to be all the malts that fall into your caramel crystal malt category, and any sort of hybridized malts kind of in there as well are usually steamed or put into the kiln when they're still wet. And that is and that's because you are actually trying to crystallize those sugars in there. So you need the water in those sugars in order to have that crystallization process, you know, unfold.
Yeah, and there are a couple other malts that kind of fall into the same category. So, of course, your entire range of crystal malts that need the water in there to caramelize, as well as carapils. That actually uses that same moisture to, instead of fully caramelizing, it glassifies some dextrins in there and gives you that more puffy mouthfeel. And then things like roasted barley are different than black malt, even though they're kind of kilned the same way. Roasted barley going into the kiln as green barley actually gives you a more astringent profile, whereas the black malts going in there after being dried gives you just as much burntness, but more of a soft burntness.
Yep. Yeah, and so also, you know, I talk about hybrid malts. These are going to be your things. Like Special X comes to my mind. Cara Munich. You know, anything with Cara is a pretty good indicator that it's...
Yeah, Cara Munich, Cara Vienne.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of another one here.
Caramel Vienne, Caramel Munich, Cara Brown.
Yeah, oh, you already said Cara Aroma, yeah. So yeah. All those good ones are going to fall into the same category. And what really separates them from, you know, the non-steamed or the dried malts before they hit the kiln is that, unlike where the dry malts won't leave you with a lot of residual sweetness, these malts definitely can, because part of that sugar caramelization process is that the sugars are way too complex for the yeast to actually ferment.
Yeah. And so you end up with a kind of hybrid between caramely, crystally characters and some softer Munich-y characters. So a combination of biscuit and crystal rather than just sweet crystal, which we use whenever we can because we avoid crystal malts like the plague.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, there's so many other malts that are better than straight caramel malts, mostly just malts that have more complex character to them than a straight caramel crystal malt.
Yeah, plus we like just breaking the mold and being different. We're rebels. And there are some specialty malts that fall kind of outside of all these categories. Actually, a honey malt or brew malt that we were talking about before is one of those. Basically, that's a malt that is done like a pseudo biscuit malt, but also treated with acid in a way and kilned in a way that it intensifies the sweetness. Common specialty malts that fall outside of that category that have different treatments that are done to them are acidulated malt, which basically goes through a lactic acid fermentation on the grain before a secondary drying process, and then like smoked malts.
Yeah, so smoked malts, pretty straightforward there. They're actually going to smoke them as they are. Actually, I don't know when. I take that back. I don't know if they smoke them before they hit the kiln. I want to say they'll probably smoke them before they hit the kiln.
I think there's two different ways to do it. I think I've seen it done both ways.
Yeah.
I think Breese does it after, and like a classic Rausch malt goes before.
Yeah. I know from smoking my own malt, it definitely helps to wet it down because the smoke actually permeates the husk of the grain more than the grain itself.
So. Smoke malt every day.
Smoke malt. Smoke malts are fun, by the way. There's so many available these days.
And I like using smoked malts, but I don't particularly like drinking smoked beers.
Yeah.
Speaking of, we gotta.
I think it's because they're not aged enough.
We gotta use our Stein beer.
Yeah, I'm sure it's tasting amazing by now.
Yeah. If you want to taste our Stein beer, come and get it. Also, if anyone out there needs a collection ball for a fast ferment or a wrap for a fast ferment. We've got some extras that we're trying to get rid of. Let us know. Pay for the shipping. We'll send it to you if you're in the United States.
Throw some comments. You know, we should actually just do that as a YouTube post. Be like, hey, yeah. comment on this post.
If you're in the United States and you want to take some stuff that we don't need anymore.
Okay. So, what else is there about malts now? Does that sum it up? I feel like we missed so much, but I guess we probably have missed a lot, but we did do some more intensive videos on malts, so there's actually a whole series of them, so please check those out if you want to learn more about malt. We break down all those different styles in detail through a series of 5 or 6 videos, which unfortunately we never did actually get to finish our malt tour because
our malt guys moved.
Because Rona, that bee.
No, it wasn't Rona. It was because Joel was out of town when we could have done it.
No, it was Rona because we rescheduled and then they.
Joel Rona'd us.
Yep, and then they Rona'd.
Well, one of the two. Anyways, eventually we'll be able to do a tour of the local malt house. There's a malt house. It's like 4 miles that way.
If that.
Yeah, so it's great that it's that close to us and we want to be able to go there and tour it and learn about malting.
All right, so let's go on to topic number 2, which is a pretty broad one, and that is going to be doing split batches and experimentation.
Yeah, a lot of people ask us, like, hey, I want to try different yeasts, but I don't brew enough to make it happen, so what should I do? It really helps, first of all, if you have a 10-gallon or bigger system, but what we like to do is take the exact same wort and split it into different batches. We're kind of doing that with our hard seltzer right now. Our strategy behind that was basically to try to eliminate as many variables as possible as quickly as possible by starting with the broadest category of experimenting, which is the yeast. Right now, like I said, we have the 3 seltzers going in with 3 different yeasts. And then from there, we're going to go into some more subtle things. And so we're going to start with the yeast one and then break down into other experimentations.
Probably water next. And then last, we'll probably mess with the nutrients, actually, which I feel like it'll have the least impact, honestly, just because they're not super high ABV things. But
I think it should, just because I think that there are some nitrogen precursors to sulfur flavors that might end up affecting it.
Yeah.
Which is why we use Fermento in that in the current batch. But anyways, there's a lot of things that go into it.
I
and
think
so,
the staggered won't be necessary, I'll bet you, if we play with that, though.
I think if you added it all at the beginning, it should still be fine.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Anyway. And then we can start playing with different things like sugar. So how do you get the most variables taken out of the way as quickly as possible? And the idea is that you're basically selecting the broadest term first and then narrowing down other variables that you need to get. So,
and I think the easiest path to start with actually lies in the system itself that you're trying to make beer on.
Yeah.
You know, I've always been a huge proponent of, you know, simplify. It's really easy to make a really complicated brew house, and ultimately the more complicated you get, the more variables you start incorporating into your brew days, which means that if you do nail something, it's going to be that much harder to repeat it.
Yeah, and so especially when scaling up, don't sacrifice consistency or efficiency for sheer size. Even though size can be really helpful, because if you're doing like split yeast experiments, for example, doing one batch, one boil, and then splitting it off into two different fermenters simultaneously, that can be a great way to figure out which yeast you like better.
Yeah, and like I say, it's, you know, it's like, I think I've said this before, but it's, and it sounds terrible, but you kind of, if you can take the human element out of things a little bit, and like automate things as much as possible, that's actually going to really help in your consistency from batch to batch. And then that's to the point where once you get that down, then you can start playing with, you know, one thing or another thing in your brew house. So.
Yeah. Logan's actually 45% robot. And so he's just, you know, he's got a thing for other robots.
What can I say? Something sexy about metal.
Yeah. So let's talk about one of the, one of the things you definitely need to know if you're doing a single boil and splitting it off into two different fermenters, and that is there's going to be variation on when the runoff or what the runoff is giving you. And so what we like to do when you're doing a single boil and splitting it into two different fermenters is actually have a T in line to make sure that we're getting as close to the exact same beer in both parts.
Yeah, which is easier said than done.
Really is.
Because one thing with a T is that you do have to make sure that you're also getting the same flow into each fermenter. Which a lot of times you'll end up getting a little bit more flow in one than in the other. So, but what that does too is as you start kind of siphoning down the beer out of your kettle, you're going to have varying degrees of trub in there. And that's why Peter's saying that you really want to use that T, because the amount of trub that goes into your beer, can actually have a significant impact on it. Sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. So it all depends on what you're brewing. But yeah, definitely splitting that off so that you, again, you have that consistency of each fermenter.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, you also want to use the same fermenters. Generally speaking, if you are using a dish bottom fermenter, you know, probably your traditional bucket, carboy, you name it, you're actually going to get a slightly different fermentation than if you have a conical fermenter.
Yeah, and so having the same fermenter in terms of shape and size is actually going to play a bigger role than you might think, for reasons like the shape of the bottom can actually affect how the yeast flocculate, how they ferment, and then they can also affect something called partial pressure on the system. So basically, if you have more liquid above a certain point, the relative pressure on that point is higher than if you have it spread out over a wider spot.
Yeah, and even a metal container versus a glass or plastic. That can affect the actual temperature at which your beer is fermenting.
Because they conduct thermalness.
Thermalness, yeah. No, really. I mean, you're going to get a free rise more or less regardless. So you're probably going to get a lot less of a free rise in the metal fermenter than you would in a plastic.
Because it's closer to ambient. Unless you've got like full-on glycol, which, you know, that's always a good way to do it.
Yeah, so if you got $2,000 kicking around, you know, glycol, that's a great way to do it.
Hey, no, we can get glycol units and everything for 5-gallon fermenters for like.
That is true. They are getting remarkably cheap nowadays. Had I still been home brewing and not just working like a dog, I would probably be seriously thinking about investing in one now.
I sure would.
All right. So otherwise, let's see.
So split batches work for things like yeast. They work for things like I don't know. Guessing your temperature.
Dry hopping.
Dry hopping. Yeah, different dry hops. Fruit additions, things like that.
Oh yeah, they're great for fruit additions. Actually, yeah. I love doing that. That's
nutrient versus not nutrient, things like that. But what about when you're experimenting with different malts? Because you can't necessarily do the same boil when you're adding an ingredient before the boil.
Yeah, definitely. So when it comes to base malts, keep them simple. If you're trying to experiment with a base malt, don't add a specialty malt in the beer with your base malt. You're trying to get a flavor of what that base malt is. Doesn't mean that you're going to have the best designed recipe ever. Probably not. But if you start adding other malts in with your base malt, now you're not tasting the base malt anymore. So the whole point of smash single malt, single hop beers, are that you are tasting very specific ingredients. you're sort of registering those in your in the back of your palate, and so you know how to then use those flavor profiles and beers in the future.
And by the way, we think that smash beers are super sexy. So smash beers are something that a lot of people just kind of look over, or they think of like, hey, I'm going to do it because of the hop. But no, I know it's really easy to get excited about things like all the different ranges of specialty malts that you can use because there's so many flavors you can build. But when you are aiming for a certain flavor and you understand that you have a base malt that does wonders for you every single time because you know what that base flavor is, that base malt experimentation is going to come in really handy. That's how we learn things like we like Heidelberg over Pilsner malt, how I like Halcyon malt over a lot of pale ale malts because I like that richness that it gives. It's a completely different flavor. So we do base malt experiments all the time, and it's a deeper understanding of what you're brewing and what you're trying to get in your final product if you really understand all the base malts that are possible, which is why we have like 40 of them here.
Actually, we have less now.
Slightly less than 40.
We've used 10 of them, I think, now. Or used up, I should say. But yeah, smashes, and they've kind of like faded away in the commercial world too. I feel like I saw a ton of them 3 or 4 years ago, and now all of a sudden I go out and I don't hardly see a smash beer anymore.
Guys, comment your favorite base malt, just to make my heart happy.
Throw it down there. Throw it in the comments. The Maris Otter 1823. I mean, how else would we have known that it had that super subtle little Teddy Graham flavor to it? Teddy Graham beers are awesome.
Yeah, it tastes just like Golden Grahams.
Golden Grahams.
Golden Teddy Grahams.
So, yeah, bring back the smash. That's what Peter's trying to tell you there.
Yeah, go watch our video on Baird's 1823 versus regular Baird's Maris Otter, by the way.
So let's talk about here a little bit of things that people often don't think about experimenting with, and that is nutrients and enzymes.
Yeah, so I have a range of enzymes that I've brought in just because I have been thoroughly impressed with how it makes it so that I can manipulate my beer even more. So that's going to be things like Clarity Firm, which a lot of people think of using Clarity Firm just because it reduces the gluten content, but you can also use Clarity Firm just as a yeast co-pitch to make it so that your yeast actually ferment cleaner.
Yeah. So
and drop out bright.
Yeah, breaking down those enzymes, dropping them out bright. Clarity Firm works really well, actually. So does Super Clear. I'm so sold on that two-part Super Clear, yeah. Or we've probably mentioned Kytosan and
Kieselsol.
Kieselsol, there we go.
Yeah, Kieselsol is the number one stage and Kytosan is the second stage. And so different fining agents. We've fallen in love with, like you said, the Super Clear over using something like gelatin.
Yeah, no, so. Gelatin has gone the way of the dodo, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Gelatin can work really well in some cases, it doesn't always work.
Plus, you got to mix it up first.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so nice when you got a liquid that's just ready to pour in.
Yeah. No, using those two-part fining agents I think it's just because they're hitting the positive and the negative ions.
Logan, everyone's commenting their favorite base malt. You should comment yours, too.
You're hitting it out of the park. My favorite base malt?
Yeah, what's your favorite base malt?
It's probably going to be definitely roasted barley.
Roasted barley is the best base malt.
Roasted barley is the best base
malt. If you don't like black coffee in the morning but you want really terrible beer, roasted barley is a base malt. I think actually, mine might be Halcyon.
Actually, Link's Munich malt, doing the smash with their Link Munich.
Yeah. We got to try more with their Francine Pilsner. So, by the way, the malt house that's right over there, we were talking about how different maltsters sometimes use, like, heritage grains and base grains. Link is one of the maltsters that's really close to us that they've been reviving ancient grains, basically, like purple Egyptian barley. So they've got a lot of fun things to play with.
Ooh, Golden Promise. That's actually...
Well, Golden Promise, pretty good.
We hated on that for a while, and then we went to the dark side.
Idaho Farmhouse Ale got a couple of bags of Heidi on a recommendation. Heidelberg malt is, it's genius. Once you make a Pilsner with Heidelberg malt, you'll never go back. Jinx. Double jinx. quickly, before we go on to other things you can experiment with, let's talk about when you're doing some specialty malts, if you want to try to get that same split batch effect. So one thing that you can do is if you want to go through the same mash, make sure that your mash is efficient. There are some specialty malts like crystal malts and roasted barley's chocolates that you actually don't need to have in the mash to get their full effect. And so you can do what's called steeping those even after the boil.
Yeah. So just like, you know, when you start out on your extract batches, all you're going to do is steep them like a big old tea bag. We've actually had really good luck doing that.
Yeah, we did that with our chocolate side by side, I believe.
Yep. It was the brown, I think, or both. Did we do both?
Might have been both.
Might have been both.
Who knows?
But yeah, it's a very, very easy way to experiment with some specialty malts, especially because obviously you're using a lot less of those. Yeah, that brown one blew my mind. That one was
hugely different.
Yeah, hugely different, but also the amount of brown malt that we put in those beers. That's really what blew my mind. I thought they were going to be way overpowering, but they weren't.
Yeah, well, one of them was.
But yeah, one of them was a little bit much.
The Simpsons, I think, was the darkest one.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so some other things you can experiment with. First of all, probably the most important thing that you guys should experiment with is trying to brew while wearing a Genus Brewing t-shirt versus not wearing a Genus Brewing t-shirt. From what I've found, if I'm wearing a Genus Brewing t-shirt while brewing, my beers are 5 times better.
Genusbrewing.com.
We get a lot of people that are requesting that we use some Ascorbs, do some Ascorbs experiments. So those might be coming up in our world, but we strongly endorse it, and we recommend that you guys try when you add Ascorbs. And how much and things like that. Like we said, we usually add it in our mash about 3 to 5 grams per 5 gallon batch.
That'll be a fun one. I'm sad though if we end up ruining a batch of beer from it.
Right.
Like as the control beer and we just oxidize the shiz out of it.
Yeah, that would be sad. Got to do a ton of hops. Let's talk about some other enzymes that we carry because we've talked about Clarity Firm. OptiMash is another one from White Labs, which is kind of does the same thing as Amylex 4T. OptiMash, basically it's a wider temperature range enzyme that's pretty strong. It makes it so that let's say you overshoot your mash efficiency, it's a great thing to have on hand because it's something that you can be like, all right, I'll just wait until my mash temperature gets down to 155 and I'll add a little bit of...
You mean your mash temperature.
Yeah.
You said efficiency.
Mash temperature.
That's right.
Yeah.
You're going to increase your efficiency with this. That's where he was going.
Right. So, if you accidentally mash in at like 160 and you're like, oh, I killed my enzymes, because that's exactly how you talk when you overshoot your strike temperature, then you can add a little bit of Amylex 4T or OptiMash.
Yeah.
And make sure that your beer still does some beer stuff.
Yeah. So that's your beta amylase, right?
It's a different amylase than alpha beta, actually.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. But it's going to help convert those sugars. We've even used it to dry a couple of beers out too, right in the last 10 minutes of the mash. So lots of options there, which actually, you know, that wouldn't be a bad idea if you don't want to use the diastaticus strain. Kind of call back to our beer of the week.
Yeah.
It would actually just be to add a little bit of extra enzyme to the end of your mash and just make sure you're converting every last bit of sugar.
Yeah. It's a little bit of amyloglucosidase in White Labs. That's Ultra Firm, which we just brought in as well.
Yep.
Another one is they also have a beta glucanase enzyme that works at mash temperatures called ViscoBuster. And that's a really fun one. We've played with that in the last like 4 batches that we've done here. And it's funny because we do overnight mashes. And so when we come in, we'll see that ViscoBuster will just there'll be no protein like settling on
like
the top of the
ball bearing of proteins sitting around in the top of the mash. You take them out and you can flick them across the floor.
Crazy.
I think that one is actually going to come in real handy with everyone that's buying these vertical brewing systems now.
Yes.
You know, everyone that's got, you know, your anvils, like we said, are coming in. Anyone that's got mash and boils, Robo Brews, whatever all the other brands are.
The ViscoBuster is going to be.
I think a little bit of ViscoBuster in your mash will actually really help with that recirculation. I know actually one of our employees just brewed a hazy and said that he struggled pretty hard with that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would fully recommend it for a hazy just yet.
We'll have to do some experimentation.
Yeah, just because you might actually take away some of those big body, because that's what beta glucanase contributes to. So, you know, maybe not quite for a hazy, but for a lot of other beers, I feel like that'll help with your mash a lot.
Someone wants a hop cat. What's a hop cat?
Hop cat. I am a hop cat.
You're a hop cat?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Does that mean instead of the dog inoculation, we're going to pitch you in?
Yes. Yes, pitch me in a beer.
That's right.
It will be the best beer ever.
We're going to be the first brewery ever to inoculate a beer with Logan. Or a cat. One of the two. All right. I think that kind of closes out most we have about experimentation. That was more just like a conversational thing. Hopefully you guys got something from it. I like all the favorite malts that you guys put out there. But let's go on to some questions, some Q&As. I know somebody says, have we played around with Great Western's High Color Pale? We used to use that in a lot of recipes, actually. It's great, especially for the price in our area.
Yeah.
I don't use it as much anymore because we have lots of options.
To me, it comes across a little biscuity. almost too much for a lot of beers. But for, I would say it works really well. I've actually used it to a great degree, mimicking German beers, actually.
Yeah.
Like I did a fantastic Doppelbock with it. But with that said, I've also done actual like American pale ales with it, and I'm not the biggest fan of it in American pale ale. But I feel like it's just, you know, like every malt, you gotta kind of find what works for you. And it's not a bad flavor at all.
Yeah. And it's super neutral too. So it's like neutral. Yeah. It's high color. It's pretty easy for, it's yeah, I endorse it. We just don't use it very much.
American amber ale will work really well on.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of like Northwest styles or like English styles, it works really well. Yeah. And it's just like,
yeah, English styles. Yeah. You can't go wrong with that malt, honestly.
But I've just, even though it's more expensive, I've just fallen in love with Halcyon. And so I use Halcyon for anything in that range.
Yep.
And then I'll build some color with other malts, basically. What, someone wants to dry out a Russian Imperial Stout but doesn't want a Brute IRS. So that's going to kind of depend. You should be able to use AMG without it completely drying out. AMG will dry out IPAs or things without a lot of specialty malts.
Yeah.
That said, if you have enough specialty malts in there, I don't think it would completely dry it out, but it might get it down lower than you want. So
yeah.
Russian Imperials can be like 10.18 to 10.24, I think. And so yeah, if you AMG'd it, it might go down to like 10.12.
You know, I'm going to say too, which is probably blasphemy, but for on a homebrew scale for a Russian Imperial Stout, brew your stout only at about maybe 10% or so, and then literally throw a fifth of whiskey or whatever you want in it, and it'll bump it up by 2 or 3%.
Why not?
Hashtag cheating.
Ain't nothing wrong with a little cheating.
Yeah, no. I mean,
little whiskey.
Then you have your barrel aged stout. I mean, that's the reality.
It sucks if you don't have good whiskey though. So yeah, don't throw some Jim Beam at that. Some quality.
Yes, that is a good point. So don't do that. Otherwise, you could buffer it with some simple sugars as well. I know I've thrown honey and various syrups. Like a maple syrup I've thrown in there, with great results. So, those will help actually dry out that final gravity, and otherwise just cut down on your total adjuncts. I know they should be high for a Russian Imperial, but, you know, maybe cut back just a little bit on those. Oh, and low mash temps before. Okay. Another question. Will we do more Will It Brew episodes? That's a tough one. So if everyone goes and watches them, then we will do more. Right now, they're just unfortunately not performing very well for us, and it takes us a lot of production time to do them. So we're kind of putting that on pause for now. Things are starting to get a little bit busier around here. So unfortunately, they just aren't really giving us the return of investment that we need to
excuse me
make it worth our while. Oh God, now Peter's in the bathroom. Peter, take over.
What'd you do?
I'm dying.
Why are you dying?
My throat all of a sudden stopped working.
Logan's throat doesn't work. All right, so someone said Sapwood released their first cider yesterday with, that was loud, with Michael Toon's My House Saison Yeast. I feel like that says cider, but it might mean seltzer. I did hear about, I think it was Sapwood, doing a farmhouse seltzer, which I think sounds super tasty. I would love to see a seltzer that's made with some more funky yeast. And so what we have going is one with the Saison yeast. And we're going to probably try it with a Quike yeast as well. So I think that if you're making hard seltzers and you want to make them more beer-like or more interesting, I think that's a great way to do it.
Whew. Okay. I'm still alive.
What is the best way to mash while grain drown rice? I don't understand that question. I think that might be misworded, or I just am not comprehending.
Whole grain brown rice. You want to do a cereal mash with it.
Is that what he's trying to say? Whole grain brown rice?
Yeah, if you're mashing rice, you're going to be hard-pressed to get any sugars from it.
Oh, yeah, I should have kept reading.
Pre-gelatinize it first.
Whole grain brown. Yeah. Yeah. You got to pre-gelatinize it. But then pour the whole shibibibibib into the mash. All of it.
Yep.
So get some nice rice cooker it. Just rice cooker the thing and then pour everything from the rice cooker into the mash. Someone asked, should I completely replace all my flame out and dry hops to cryo hops? Yes. As long as you got some pellets or plant matter in there some other time.
Yeah. It's,
The flame out, not, I mean, the flame out, I like to go like mostly cryos with a little bit of pellets. Dry hop, definitely all cryos.
Yeah, unless you're buying hops in bulk, the price point is so similar, and it actually saves you some losses in your beer. It's one of those, to me, just why not situations. So,
What is a deciding factor in how long wort should be boiled? That comes down to two different things. First of all, how much extra flavor do you want off of your beer? Long boils are great for like big boozy beers. They're good for small beers that you just want extra character for. And they actually produce some compounds that help keep your beer more shelf stable as well. Or anything time you want a high efficiency beer. So also big boozy beers, you might go for a longer boil. If you don't care about your efficiency so much, just do a short boil. There's beers that we've done for like a 30-minute boil, and that's fine.
Done no minute boils.
0 minute boils.
Yeah.
Really depends on if you have that DMS precursor, which not every malt has. So a while ago, almost all malts had, or under-modified malts had SMM, S-methylmethionine. And if your malt has that, or if you're using an under-modified malt that would have SMM, then you can get that cooked corn vegetal flavor from not boiling. The other thing would be like if your grain's stored improperly, it can be slightly oxidized, which creates something called DMSO. And then that can also be a reason that you would definitely need to boil longer. But for the most part, highly modified malts, if they're stored well, you don't have to worry about that.
All right. I got one that somebody's asking about, setting up cheap glycol chillers for 5-gallon batches. And the one that we've had here that actually has been
perfect,
performing pretty well. It's probably oversized for 5-gallon batches, honestly, but that's the Chillmax 4.
It's from Brewbuilt.
From Brewbuilt.
You can find it on more beer. Brewbuilt, I think it's like, it might be the Ice Master or Chillmax. Yeah. I don't know, but it's the 4-prong one. You can definitely fully, chill 4 different carboys, crash 4 different carboys, and then the Blickman rods that I have coming in that fit into a stopper.
Yeah, and that chiller retails perfect. At I think about 600 or so,
maybe 700.
Yeah, it might be 700, which is still expensive, but it has come down in price a lot. But we're depending on, you know, I'm excited for those Blickman rods because another sort of hack, which would not be ideal, but would certainly work for a 5-gallon batch, is I have seen fish tank cooling units.
Oh, yeah.
And they're basically like a little air conditioner, really, really small air conditioner unit that you pump through. So you would pump through some glycol through it or some water through it, pump it through your cooling rod. And those are actually even cheaper. I've seen those as cheap as like a couple $100.
Yeah.
So
we almost bought some off of Wish for.
Yeah,
for
they're. So if you're only trying to cool one or maybe two batches, that's always an option too. I think any more than maybe, you know, 10 gallons of beer, I don't think those fish tank coolers are going to be able to handle it just because they don't have the power on them. You know, they're like 1/10 horsepower compressors in them or something like that. So,
but definitely enough for 1 or 2 5-gallon batches.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another option you can do too. And then, yeah, finding something like the cooling rods that we're getting from Blickman. So,
yeah. What yeast works best for our Castor Moonshire recipe? We use the 3470 most often. However, if you can get to hold of some liquid yeasts, yeah. The original was a classic German ale strain. They both work. What you're looking for is a very neutral profile with just a slightly malt-leaning feel. So
yeah,
anything in that coal strain, Cal Lager works well.
Yeah, we've used the Dieter too, the Cal Lager. I think the best that we've done, though, is when we have any of those ale strains is just fermenting them on the cold side. And again, I mean, can't say it enough, with a really big pitch.
Yeah.
Have been the best batches that have turned out for us. I mean, this last one was actually the Köln strain from Lallemand.
Yeah.
That we fermented it with. And that one's slightly fruitier. But again, having a nice, healthy pitch, we fermented it at 62. So stayed really nice and clean for us.
Have us guys use that Philly sour yeast? No, but it is coming, and we will use it.
Yep. Yeah, we got to start using actually all those
big
all
pitches.
Those Omega yeasts.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
We got a bunch of Omegas to try. Yeah, everyone liked the live stream. Someone just commented to like the live stream. There are 125 of you watching. There are 34 likes and 1 dislike. So whoever disliked us, it doesn't really matter. But if you want to give us a like, that'd be cool. You should do it.
All right. Well, let's grab a couple more questions before we close out.
I have a porter stuck at 10:34. Any advice to avoid exploding bottles? It depends on the OG, I guess.
It might just be done if it's really big too. Yeah. But
just make sure that it's consistent. You might try just increasing the temperature for a little bit and seeing if it drops some more.
Yeah. I mean, if it tastes good, I would say watch it for a few weeks and make sure it doesn't drop anymore. And then go ahead and bottle it up. But that is a pretty high final gravity for a beer.
You can always zyme it, too.
Yep.
Or there's a – before zyming, my first – if it's a stuck ferment, my first action would be some yeast energizer.
Yeah. We got Doug's asking about quike in a dry Irish stout. And I want to say, heck yeah, if the 100% Brett Irish stout that we did – is any indicator of what you might get as a result, I think the quike would be fantastic. Worst case scenario, you end up with more of a tropical stout, I guess.
Definitely worth a shot. I'd be on the trat.
Definitely. I think it'd be really good. So,
Someone's asking if you can take a final gravity hydrometer reading when it's carbonated from the keg. You definitely have to knock out the carbonation because that carbonation is extra dissolved bits that will increase the gravity. And so you got to wait for that carbonation to knock out. And then the hydrometer will be more accurate.
Yeah. Do we warm our fermenter once we pitch our quike yeast or just pitch it right at 100 from the kettle? Typically, we'll just pitch it right at 100. It's easier that way.
We just don't chill as much.
Yeah, and yes, I know the trade-off is that you're not going to get as much dissolved oxygen in there. But it seems like quike is less picky about oxygen and more picky about nutrients for the most part.
So yeah, and you can always add,
depending on the strain, I guess.
Yeah, you can always add more oxygen, like the partway into fermentation. Not a lot into fermentation, but let's say
about 24 hours.
Yeah, let's say the first third of sugar depletion.
Damn.
What's the difference between Maris Otter and Golden Promise as a base malt? Golden Promise is a little bit more malt leaning. And it kind of depends on the Maris Otter, too. So a lot of Maris Otters are actually relatively neutral, whereas Golden Promises will have a little bit more of like a light toasted bread kind of character.
Yeah.
And they have a really good mouthfeel, too.
Yeah, they've got more of a like popcorn meets Cheerio mouthfeel to them, if that makes any sense.
Popcorn without the butter.
Yeah. Well, obviously, no butter. Yeah. Like actual popcorn.
Yeah. Oh. They're nice. Definitely play around with them.
Yeah, either way, you can't go wrong. All right.
Should I add vitamin C small pills while bottle conditioning with dextrose? No. You should get ascorbic acid is really cheap to just get in pure form, like dissolvable form. You can go onto morebeer.com and get ascorbic acid from them. I think it's like for a lot of it, it's like $5.
Yeah.
So I would just get actual ascorbic acid. Vitamin C has other stuff in it that can taste bad.
Yeah. All right. Well, we had a great conversation with you today, but I think it is time to wrap it up. We open in exactly 9 minutes now, so we have lots of work to do. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Peter, I know you're reading more questions.
I am. Favorite cheap-ass trailer park beer? Keystone? No, it's probably Coors Light for me.
But thank you all for tuning in. Please come back next week. We do this live stream every Sunday at 8:45 Pacific Standard Time. Come with your questions. Grab your morning beer and we'll see you next week.